Environmental Law Institute Supreme Court Preview. We're really grateful for the panelists to come and speak with us today and for you for being here. The last 2 years have been fairly interesting ones for environmental law in front of the Supreme Court. We've had one term where we had almost 10% of the cases were environmentally related. Last year we had a fairly water-related term for the environmental perspective. And this year we look to be looking towards air instead. We're going to hear today just those two air cases. We'll hear about Massachusetts and the NSR case. Talk about global warming and what it means to be a modification under the Clean Air Act to add regulatory requirements. Those are fairly important questions, as well as some standing issues that come up. And to talk about that with us today, we have three wonderful folks who are going to bring a both scholarly and practitioner perspective to the table. We're going to start with Amanda Leiter, or we're going to start with Richard Lazarus, but in terms of who's sitting up here, we'll start with Amanda Leiter, who is now a visiting associate professor of law at Georgetown University Law Center. Professor Leitner will be teaching the Environmental Workshop in Administrative Law. Her research interests include the factors that motivate and constrain federal agency action and the limits of traditional federal law rules for addressing environmental disputes. She was recently a litigation fellow at the Natural Resources Defense Council, where she worked on clean air issues. Prior to joining NRDC, she was a law clerk to Justice John Paul Stevens of the U.S. Supreme Court, to Judge David Tatel of the U.S. Court of Appeals, and to Judge Nancy Gertner of the Federal District Court for the District of Massachusetts. Richard Lazarus, as you probably know, is a professor of law at Georgetown University Law Center, where he teaches environmental law, natural resources law, Supreme Court advocacy, and torts. He's also the faculty director for the Supreme Court Institute, and he's a columnist for the Environmental Forum here at ELR. He's previously worked for the Justice Department, both in the Environmental and Natural Resources Division, and the Solicitor General's Office, where he was assistant to the Solicitor General. Professor Lazarus has represented the United States, state and local governments, and environmental groups in the Supreme Court in approximately 37 cases, many of which raised natural resource and environmental law issues. His legal scholarship is in the area of environmental and natural resources law. He has most recently published law review articles on environmental legal history, Supreme Court and environmental law, and the Fifth Amendment Just Compensation Clause and environmental justice. And last but certainly not least is Don Elliott, who's a partner with Wilkie Farr & Gallagher here in Washington, D.C., where he chairs the Worldwide Environmental Law Department. Mr. Elliott has over 25 years of experience in all aspects of environmental and product liability litigation, including having served as general counsel of the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency from 1989 to 1991. He advises companies in both the European Union and the United States on environmental aspects of complex corporate and real estate sales and acquisitions, and also represents companies and trade associations on major regulatory policy issues, class action litigation, product liability, and legislative matters. From 1981 through 1993, Mr. Elliott served as a tenured professor at the Yale Law School, teaching complex litigation, torts, environmental law, and many other topics. And he continues as an adjunct professor today. So with that, I'll turn it over, and once again, thanks to our panel.
And also at Georgetown. We have to give them equal time.
Right.
I'm delighted to be here. This is a tradition which I enjoy, coming to ELI and talking about the upcoming Supreme Court term. What we're going to do this time is I'm going to talk for just a few minutes in general, a little bit about the court. And then Don Elliott is going to talk about the Duke Energy case. And then Amanda Leiter is going to talk about the Massachusetts versus EPA, the global climate change case. That's really what we're focusing on. And then we'll take questions. We'll probably comment on what each other has said. We've each brought our competing statutory books, so we keep each other honest about what the statute says, and then open up to questions and the rest. You know, about a year ago, we were just finishing the confirmation hearings for now Chief Justice Roberts. We were waiting to see what was going to happen. Harriet Myers was the nominee about a year ago, waiting to see what was going to happen with the O'Connor slot. And there was a lot of debate about what was going to happen to environmental law under the new court, under the Roberts Court, as compared to under the Rehnquist Court. Some environmentalists had expressed a fair amount of concern about the new Chief Justice, based on his hapless toad reference in his D.C. Circuit opinion. The court denied rehearing en banc. Other environmentalists were sort of more neutral about Roberts, because his litigating position as a lawyer, he had represented lots of different kinds of sides. They weren't quite sure how to read that, but that bordered more on neutrality. And there were some property rights folks, who I remember quite well, condemned the nominee. Pacific Legal Foundation came out quite strongly against Roberts. They referred to him as a property rights disaster in the making. O'Connor's a swing vote on property, while Roberts will be the property owners who will be twisting in the wind. A year later, it's obviously still too early to figure out where the Roberts Court is going, but we've got some data. We've got some early few data points worth talking about. Clearly, this court's not disinterested in environmental law, for better or for worse, but they're not disinterested. Almost as soon as Roberts took the helm, they granted 3 Clean Water Act cases on the very first order list last year. That was the S.D. Warren case, Rapanos, and Carabel, and they granted 2 Clean Air Act cases already for this term. They granted a Dormant Commerce Clause sort of state waste regulation case, and they asked the Solicitor General for his views in a case involving CERCLA, the Superfund statute, and contribution rights. This is a follow-up to the court's decision a few terms ago in Cooper v. ABL Services. So that, too, if the SG tells them to take the case, would be a significant case. The court is also proving, I think, at the jurisdictional stage, to be a bit more ambidextrous on its CERC grants than the court has historically. And not getting to the merits, I just want to talk, the 2 Clean Air Act cases are both unusual historically. They were both granted over the government's opposition. In both cases, the United States government opposed Supreme Court review, and in both cases, the court granted it. And in both cases, it was the environmentalists seeking review. It wasn't industry seeking review. And it's the environmental position that had lost in the court below. In Massachusetts versus EPA, it was both a lot of states and the environmentalists. In the Duke Energy case, it was environmental defense going against Duke Energy. That combination almost never happens. When the court grants cert in environmental cases, about 87% of the time, the position that won below was the environmental position. It's a claim that the courts have gone too far. They've overreached the statutes. The court very rarely grants review when there's a claim of underreaching in the environmental area. And almost the only times they ever do it is if the United States is the petitioner, like the American Trucking, the Whitman versus American Trucking, or maybe a bunch of states, a little bit like Massachusetts versus EPA. But this is very rare. The Duke Energy case, where environmental defense was the petitioner over the government's opposition, that's the first time since 1971 that the Supreme Court has granted review at the exclusive request of an environmental group to hear a case on review. That's Sierra Club v. Morton. You got to go back a long time to find anyone. In fact, in 1971, there's not a single justice on the court now who was on the court back in 1971. So it's a long time ago. So it's quite remarkable. And as you'll see when people talk about these cases, neither of these cases was an obvious cert grant at all. These were both very difficult cert grants. Both the Duke Energy case, where it was the government's enforcement action, and the government didn't want to seek cert, that's hard to get the court to grant. And Amanda will tell you, in the Massachusetts versus EPA, there was no opinion in many respects of the court below. So it was hard to say it was of wide precedential effect. So the court looks a little more even-handed. They've been even-handed for decades once they grant cert. They're very balanced, I think, in how they grant cert, what they do on the merits. But they've been sort of uneven-handed in what cases they grant cert. They're there to correct accusations of overreaching. They haven't been there to correct accusations of underreaching. Once they have it, they're pretty fair on how they decide the cases. Lest the environmentalists get a little too heady about their prospects now under the Roberts Court, though, the last term was decidedly mixed for them. You've got the S.D. Warren case, which is a Section 401 Clean Water Act case, which the state of Maine and the Friends of Presumpscot River. I should mention that I represented the Friends of Presumpscot River, so the respondents in that case. We won big. We won 9-0. That looks good. It was a slam dunk case. It was a really easy, plain meaning statutory construction case. It was a mistake the court ever granted cert in the case. Some law clerk really blew it in the cert pool memo because there just wasn't much to that case, and the court shouldn't have granted it. Once they granted it, I was delighted for us to walk away with a win. But that was just maintaining the status quo. That was not moving the ball in any direction. That's a classic Supreme Court grant of an accusation of overreaching when, in fact, there was nothing much to it. And the Rapanos and Carabel cases
I'm not going to obviously regurgitate what was decided in those cases. We can talk about it later. Just broader significance. One, Justice Kennedy maintained his clearly preeminent position in these environmental cases. Kennedy has been the majority in every single environmental case before the court since he joined the court, with one exception. And that's Alaska v. EPA, the Clean Air Act case a few years ago. It was O'Connor joined Ginsburg for the fifth vote. Kennedy was in dissent. Every other time, he's the bellwether of the Supreme Court. He's always in the majority, and he was again in Rapanos and Carabel, where you've got Stevens with his four, saying that Army Corps of Engineer regulations broadly construed navigable waters are great. You've got Scalia with his four, really completely dramatic reinterpretation, at least from the agency's perspective, of the scope of navigable waters. And you've got Kennedy right there in the middle. And Kennedy's view, as people see in the subsequent cases, is controlling in that situation. Everyone's looking to Kennedy. What's fascinating about Kennedy's view is, as a matter of theoretical theory, he pretty much rejected almost everything that Scalia said. Almost every major tenet of the of plurality opinion for the court, Kennedy rejects. He's very close, as a matter of theory, to Stevens. But for one very important difference, which has huge practical effect, and that is he wouldn't agree with Stevens that the current regulations were okay. So he found the current regulations invalid. That's a huge difference then, because now the agency has to come up with new regulations. And that's hard to do. And they'll be doing it with an ambiguous statutory term under Chevron 2, so the agency, in fact, has a lot of wiggle room of what they do in the future. So it's a big difference, and a tremendous amount of regulatory uncertainty has been created as a result of that opinion, even though Kennedy was really just a hairbreadth away from Stevens in terms of what the statute can, in fact, encompass. He just didn't believe that the regulations were close enough. The bigger concern, I think, for environmentalists from that case is the fact that the Chief Justice and Justice Alito joined Justice Scalia's opinion, plurality opinion, in the Rapanos and Carabel case. That was not an opinion one would generally refer to as a modest, understated opinion, nor would one expect Justice Scalia to have a modest, understated opinion. It's a sort of very over-top opinion with a lot of rhetorical zeal to it, a lot of condemnation of the Army Corps of Engineers, and a lot of sort of dismissiveness, and some people thought a little bit of mocking of the Clean Water Act and the rest. It wasn't the kind of thing that people wanted to see the Chief Justice or Justice Alito join, and that was sort of a surprise to see that they joined that opinion without any kind of separate, Roberts sort of separate concurring, but without any kind of distancing of himself from what Justice Scalia had said plurality. That seemed anomalous in light of his sort of stated judicial philosophy of judicial minimalism. If it's not necessary to decide more, it's necessary not to decide more. It's what he's said several times. Scalia wasn't doing that. And often anomalies can be the most revealing. With that beginning, we're going to move to talk about the two principal cases before the court, which are going to get a lot of attention, and that's going to be the Duke Energy case and then Massachusetts versus EPA.
Thank you, Richard. Very thoughtful, as always. I should start out by acknowledging that I have two personal involvements with the NSR issue. Luckily, they're on opposite sides of the issue. I certainly dealt with the NSR issue at some length when I was general counsel of EPA with Jerry Yamada, who's here. And then more recently, I represented Ohio Edison, one of the utilities which in the NSR cases, but I served primarily as their settlement counsel. Ohio Edison decided to settle its case rather than continue to litigate it, and certainly I think one factor is that we were skeptical that the courts were going to be able to get the NSR issues sorted out within any kind of reasonable time period to allow the utilities to make decisions and plan. I'm certainly not here as a spokesperson for my client, but I think they're glad they settled rather than up in the Supreme Court with all the uncertainties that would entail. And as I told Darren Samuelson a few years ago, I predict that there will have to be three Supreme Court cases on NSR. There will take about 10 years before the Supreme Court can really get the law in that area straightened out. I think Richard raised a very interesting issue, and that is to what extent is the Supreme Court capable of playing a productive role in environmental law? I think many of these cases are so complicated and involve so much history that they really challenge the lawmaking capability of the Supreme Court to understand how a particular case fits into the overall texture of the law. And therefore, sometimes the Supreme Court's opinions go off on a literal wording tangent or create more harm than good. I think this case is a perfect example of that. Maybe we'll talk about others. It will be interesting to see if the WL case, the court's decision in the Duke Energy case, brings more clarity to the NSR issues or more confusion. I also think of these cases, both of them, as representing very interesting aspects of the development of the basic Chevron paradigm defining the relationship between courts and agencies. And we can talk a little bit more about my views of Massachusetts versus EPA in that regard in the dialogue period. But with regard to the NSR case, the Duke Energy case, there are two interesting aspects that really challenge the ability of the very simple Chevron paradigm to essentially define the relationship between reviewing courts and agencies. And that is the utter complexity of the issue. This is an extremely complex regulatory issue with over 20 years of history. It seems unlikely to me that the court will really be able to understand what's going on. And then the second, I think, challenge is the challenge, as I said in an article I wrote a couple of years ago for Metropolitan Corporate Counsel about these issues, the question of who speaks for EPA. The original Chevron paradigm that courts should defer to agency interpretations was obviously too simplistic. There is no such thing as an agency interpretation. There are a variety of different ways that agencies can speak to the law. And over time, the NSR cases have involved virtually all, not all, but virtually all of the different ways that different parts of EPA can speak to an issue. The narrow issue, as Richard alluded to, is the definition of what is a modification under the Clean Air Act. For purposes of the prevention of significant deterioration regulations, or perhaps what is a major modification as opposed to a modification. And there have generally been two competing interpretations. One, which has generally been supported by industry over the years, is that there is only an increase in emissions if there's an increase in the emission rate from a particular plant. That is, if it produces more pollution per unit time. The position that EPA is taking, at least in its enforcement cases, is that whether or not there has been an increase in pollution is determined by the annual tonnage emitted from the plant. The primary difference between the two is if you have an old plant that isn't able to operate most of the time or isn't able to operate a substantial portion of the time, and you repair it, you get it back in shape, even if you don't increase its emission rate, nonetheless you can likely increase the annual amount of pollution that it's producing because you get it back online. And that is the core of the policy issue, which has been debated in various forums over about 20 years. And I'm going to quickly run you through the history because I think you need it, just like the court will need it, to be able to understand what's going on here. The PSD provisions of the Act were really created by lawsuit. There was no PSD provisions, Prevention of Significant Deterioration, as the original 1970 Clean Air Act. And there was a lawsuit by the Sierra Club. It was affirmed without opinion in the D.C. Circuit and then affirmed again by an equally divided Supreme Court. So with that guidance, EPA was told in 1976 to develop some regulations to prevent deterioration of air quality in the so-called clean areas which meet the National Ambient Air Quality Standard. It responded with an initial set of regulations in 1976. In 1977, Congress then amended the statute in the 1977 amendments, and it made some changes. It incorporated portions of the 76 regulations, and it made some changes. Most significantly for purposes of this case, the original statutory basis of the PSD regulations did not apply to modifications of plants at all. It only applied to a new plant, new construction of a plant. And 3 or 4 months after the 1977 amendments, in some technical and corrective amendments, Congress stated that, quote, the term construction, when used in connection with any source or facility, includes the modification, paren, as defined in 42 U.S.C. 7411A of any source or facility. That's really the language that's at issue in this case, and it does two things. Number one, it brings within the PSD program not just the construction of a new plant, but the modification of an existing plant. And then in language, which is really at the core of this case, in a little parenthetical, it says, as defined in Section 42 U.S.C. 7411. 42 U.S.C. 7411A, for those of you who don't know the statute by heart, is the existing definition of modification in a different section of the Clean Air Act, a different program under the Clean Air Act, the so-called New Source Performance Standard section of the Clean Air Act, or NSPS. And the essential issue in the Duke case is whether or not EPA is permitted to define the term modification differently for purposes of the PSD program than for the NSPS program in light of that language in the technical amendments that modification is, quote, as defined in 42 U.S.C. 7411. Well, shortly after the modern PSD regulations were promulgated in 1990, there were a couple of interpretations by the then head of the stationary source branch that issues PSD applicability interpretations, a person named Ed Reich. And those Reich determinations actually support the industry position that you've got to have an increase in emissions. And so EPA, in the case, is kind of walking away from those, saying those were merely the erroneous ruminations of a mid-level official, and therefore they're not entitled to Chevron deference under cases like United States versus Meade. Moving on until about 1988, the EPA interpretations began to change in that there were applicability determinations in 1988 saying, well, if you have an increase in the hours of operations and it's related to or enabled by a physical construction project, then that has a different result than just purely increasing operations. So beginning of a change in position. And then in 1990, a decision in the Seventh Circuit called the WEBCO decision. I won't go into all of the details about that, but the agency responded with some 1992 regulations. And then in 1999, the Clinton administration began the current NSR enforcement initiative against the utilities, enunciating a very clear position that if a plant's annual emissions increase, that's a violation of the law triggering PSD. Interestingly enough, the current Bush administration in some 2005 regulations has at least prospectively attempted to walk away from that interpretation and go back to an emission rate increase, and portions of those regulations have been stayed by the D.C. Circuit in an opinion that's very much in the scene but is not has not had cert granted with it. I said in an article the kindest thing that one could say about EPA's interpretations is that they have been vacillating. Consistent over a period of time. So then we get to the Duke case. Well, what happens in Duke is that Judge Bullock, Chief Judge Bullock in the district court, who is a Reagan appointee, grant summary judgment in favor of the industry based largely on the contemporaneous interpretations, the 1981 Reich applicability determinations. That probably would have been correct prior to Chevron and back when Judge Bullock went to law school, where you gave greater deference to contemporaneous interpretations. But nobody has much defended Judge Bullock's opinion under Chevron. because after United States versus Meade came down, the decision by a person other than the head of the agency is probably entitled to a lesser deference. So the case goes up to the Fourth Circuit, and Judge Luttig, who was the head of the Office of Legal Counsel at EPA when Jerry and I were there, and is now a distinguished judge on the First Circuit, decides that the parties have completely gotten everything wrong. They don't understand their own case, and goes off on a tangent. He and the rest of the panel call for supplemental briefs on an obscure case called United States versus Rowan. United States versus Rowan is a tax case in which the Supreme Court held that the word wages in two different sections of the tax code were intended by Congress to mean the same thing. Right? So Judge Luttig's take on the case, and basically the basis for the lower court opinion in Duke, is in light of the statutory language that says there's only one definition of modification, citing United States versus Rowan, it's got to mean the same thing for PSD purposes as it means for NSPS purposes. At that point, the Environmental Defense Fund files a petition for cert. As Richard mentioned, the United States opposes the petition for cert, even though it has lost below, and nonetheless the Supreme Court grants cert. It seems to me that the primary issue on which they granted cert was Section 307B2 of the Clean Air Act, which is a provision that gives exclusive jurisdiction to review and invalidate national regulations to the D.C. Circuit. And it further says in Section 307B2 that after 60 days, you can't get review in any other forum of an issue that, quote, could for which review could have been obtained when the regulation came out. So the first issue, and it is the first issue in the cert petition, and it is the first issue in the briefs, and it is probably the issue which the court will devote a lot of attention to, is did the Fourth Circuit go beyond its proper jurisdiction? Did it merely reject EPA's interpretation of the regulations in its enforcement case, which would have been proper? Or did it invalidate the regulations? Did it invalidate the regulations themselves by essentially saying, in light of the statutory language and United States versus Rowan, there's only one meaning of the regulations possible? Meanwhile, after the Fourth Circuit issues its opinion, the D.C. Circuit stays the 2004-2005 regulation changes opines in what might be regarded as dicta that the Fourth Circuit has gotten it wrong, and they don't think United States versus Rowan is binding. And in any event, the petitioners in the case in the D.C. Circuit hadn't properly raised the United States versus Rowan argument. And thereafter, the Seventh Circuit, in an opinion by Judge Posner, which I think is not very helpful for industry, says two things. Number one, that Judge Posner thinks Judge Luttig, by the way, his rival to be appointed to the Supreme Court, has gotten it wrong, and that the Fourth Circuit went more broadly than it should have. They should have deferred this issue to the D.C. Circuit. And in addition, in what I think is a even more significant portion of the opinion, basically argues that the actual annual emissions test that EPA is propounding in the enforcement cases is a correct interpretation of the Clean Air Act, because as a policy matter, if you didn't interpret the language that way, it would result in increases in pollution. What is up for grabs in light of the D.C. Circuit opinion and the Synergy opinion is whether or not the EPA may define, under Chevron, may define the term modification differently, or whether or not it's bound by the statute so that any emissions increase means actual increase in annual emissions. So we have a very interesting situation in which industry and the Fourth Circuit are arguing under Chevron 1 that the language modification may only have one meaning, namely the same meaning that it had in 1980 in the NSPS regulations, although they do acknowledge that they can change them. They just have to change them in tandem, but they have to mean the same thing. And the D.C. Circuit and Judge Posner in the Seventh Circuit are at least implying it may be a Chevron 1 issue in the other direction, that the statute itself establishes the actual annual emissions test. Well, there are strong briefs by all concerned, and I won't go on at length to recite the arguments other than to note some of the interesting things. First of all, Duke makes a somewhat different argument than it had made in the past, and it argues that to be a major modification for PSD purposes, you have to be a modification first. So it's a two-step process, and Duke's argument in the Supreme Court, which I think it's fair to say they didn't make that clearly below, is that you first have to satisfy the emission rate test to be a modification, and then secondly, you have to be determined to be a major modification, and that major modification, oh yes, everybody concedes, that's the actual annual emissions test. So Duke tries to have a place for both. It says you have to have an emissions rate increase, and you also have to have an actual rate increase. The United States obviously disagrees. The United States argues, I think, quite strongly that the Rowan case is not correctly cited here. First, they point out somewhat pointedly that it's a pre-Chevron case. Back in the days when courts were deciding what statutes meant for themselves rather than deferring to agency interpretations. And it also argues that there are different purposes to the PSD program and the NSPS program, and therefore that the agency is free to interpret them as having different meanings to serve different policy purposes. As perhaps the crux of the case comes down to a statement in the government's brief that, quote, it's on page 39, quote, Congress's repeated use of an ambiguous term reflects a repeated delegation, not a command of parity, right? So that's the essence of the U.S. position. Yes, they admit that the statute says as defined in such and so, but they say that definition is ambiguous, and so by saying as defined, the United States takes the position that that's a grant of Chevron deference to define the two terms differently in light of the different policy purposes that are involved. The Environmental Defense Fund also has an excellent brief. Several people on the phone are friends of mine, like Vicki Patton and Caleb Jaffe and Richard Lazarus all worked on it, so it's really an excellent brief. It rather tellingly makes the point that the Duke argument is, quote, painful reading, because they're walking away from the positions that they've taken below. They're not defending the Fourth Circuit opinion very, very strongly. They're really trying to create a new argument in the Supreme Court, which is always quite quite difficult to do. Let me just close by saying I think that the issue, at least under 307, is going to turn on whether or not the court views the Fourth Circuit opinion as merely invalidating the EPA interpretation that underlies its enforcement case, or views it as invalidating the regulation itself. And on that, the Environmental Defense Fund makes a strong argument that not only could Duke have challenged the 1980 interpretations, but they argue that Duke did challenge the 1980 interpretations, that they were part of an industry-wide challenge to the 1980 regulations that resulted in something called the CMA settlement, in which EPA promised to propose for comment the very interpretation that industry now supports. It proposed that interpretation for comment in the Clinton administration and then decided not to accept it. So the Environmental Defense Fund makes, a very strong environmental defense makes a very strong argument that not only was this something that could have been challenged under Section 307, but in fact it was. Duke, on the other hand, makes a very interesting argument. How could we challenge the interpretation of the 1980 regulations? Because that was not the interpretation that EPA maintained at the time. In the 1981 applicability determinations, they were reading the 1980 regulations just the way that we do now. So how could we possibly have gone to court challenging an interpretation of the 1980 regulations, which was not, in fact, the EPA interpretation at the time. Rather, it was an interpretation that we agreed with. Well, I'll leave it there for now, but let me just say I think one of the things that both parties have missed that is really crucial to the case is there was originally in the 1980 regulations a proposed definition of reconstruction. And reconstruction is part of the new source performance standard world. You have both a reconstruction and a modification. Reconstruction means making a new capital investment in a plant in order to keep it online longer. And that was originally that was part of the original 1976 PSD regulations. It was proposed in 1979, and then it was explicitly taken out in the final. And I think one of the things that all the sides have missed is the significance of the fact that the 1980 regulations did not include the definition of reconstruction, and that over time, EPA's interpretations have really sort of segued in the direction of getting the reconstruction concept, getting the concept that when you make capital repairs to a plant to keep it online longer, they've really interpreted that back into modification. So I think it would be a much stronger argument for the industry to argue that when it says defined as modification, that should have been understood at the time as meaning defined as modification, not reconstruction, because there were those two existing concepts. But that's why it's lucky for environmental defense that they're arguing against the people they're arguing against rather than me.
All right. I will start with Massachusetts v. EPA, and I apologize to people on the phone. I do have some PowerPoint slides. I'll try to read them where the actual text is relevant. I wanted to start with the questions presented. The first, it was not actually granted by the court but is likely to come up, as we've already heard, is whether the petitioners have standing to bring this case at all. The questions that the court actually granted are whether EPA has authority to regulate air pollutants associated with climate change, which I'll refer to as greenhouse gases, under Section 202A1 of the Clean Air Act. And I'll call that the authority question, statutory authority question. And then the second question that was granted is whether the agency may decline to issue greenhouse gas emission standards for motor vehicles based on policy considerations that aren't specifically enumerated in that section of the Act. I'll start by giving you guys a little history. In 1999, various groups petitioned EPA to set standards for greenhouse gas emissions from new cars. After notice and comment and a lot of wrangling, the agency ultimately denied the petition on two grounds, the two grounds that come up in the two questions that the court granted. First, they said that EPA lacks authority because, in their view, greenhouse gases are not air pollutants under the Act. And second, even if the agency does have authority to regulate greenhouse gases, it nevertheless has the discretion not to, and it wouldn't, because doing so wouldn't be effective or appropriate, in quotes, effective or appropriate at this time. Various groups petitioned the D.C. Circuit to review this rulemaking, or effectively denial of rulemaking. The D.C. Circuit rejected the challenge, and they did so in a very confused fashion, as Richard suggested. There were three opinions. Judge Randolph agreed with the agency that it had discretion not to regulate greenhouse gases, and he expressly sort of circumvented the standing question and the question of agency authority and went straight to agency discretion. The agency had said that it would not regulate on, it said, even if we had authority, we would not regulate for four reasons. First, they say Clean Air Act regulation of greenhouse gases, as opposed to some sort of new congressional action in the area, would result in an inefficient and piecemeal approach to climate change. Second, they said climate change raises foreign policy considerations that are better left to somebody other than EPA. Third, there may not be the technologies available to control greenhouse gas emissions from cars. And fourth, they asserted that there's significant scientific uncertainty about climate change. Randolph, in his opinion, as I said, circumvents the standing question, circumvents the authority question, and basically adopts these four rationales for a refusal to exercise discretion to regulate in this area. Judge Sentell expressly concurs in Randolph's judgment, but denies the petition for a different reason. He finds that the petitioners lack standing because they seek a, quote, generalized public good, close quote, and therefore their remedy is better sought through a legislature and not through a court, effectively. Judge Tatel dissents on all of these points. He finds that the petitioners do have standing, and his most significant rationale for that is that a bunch of the petitioners are states. There are 12 states involved, and he says the states, at very least, have ground to be concerned that states with coastline in particular, to be concerned that they'll have significant expenses associated with climate change, and therefore they clearly would be injured by climate change, and therefore they have standing to raise a concern that EPA is not adequately acting in this arena. There's a petition for rehearing or rehearing en banc, which is denied, but again with split decisions. The petition for rehearing is denied on the same 2-1 split, and the petition for rehearing en banc is a 4-3 split with Judges Tatel, Rogers, and Griffith in the minority. And for those of you counting, there were a couple of judges who didn't participate in the case. So I'll go back to the questions presented now and walk through those. I'm going to defer the standing question for a second because I think it relates better to some stuff I'm going to discuss at the end. So turning to the first question that the court actually granted, the authority question, this one seems to me to be, and I should give the same disclosure that NRDC is a party to this case, and I was there, although I wasn't working on this case. But it seems to me this one pretty clearly comes out in favor of petitioners. If you look at the language of Section 202, the agency is directed, shall regulate, emission of any air pollutant, and the word any appears both here and then if you look down in the next section, 302G, it appears twice there, any air pollution agent and any physical or chemical substance. So anyway, 202A1 directs the administrator to regulate emission of any air pollutant from new motor vehicles, which in his judgment cause or contribute to air pollution, which may reasonably be anticipated to endanger public health or welfare. And then skipping down to 302H, welfare is expressly defined to include weather and climate. So if you just look at the question whether the agency has authority under these three provisions, I'm actually hard-pressed to find much of an argument that they don't. There's some suggestion that I've left out a word in the definition that I cited in the top bullet point, but there's a word agent that appears there, an agent of air pollution, and there's some suggestion that that may leave a little leeway for the agency or the position that the agency lacks authority, but I actually find this question hard to resolve against agency authority. I think the much harder question is the second one that the court granted, which is whether there is room for the agency to decline to exercise its or to decline to regulate and to exercise its discretion not to regulate. And there the problem for the petitioners comes from the inclusion of that phrase in his judgment. There is clearly room for some exercise of the administrator's judgment. And the question is, to what is the administrator supposed to direct his judgment? So far, we only have the brief of petitioners, but what they say is this judgment call is limited to a determination of whether the air pollutants in question, carbon dioxide from new cars, may reasonably be anticipated to endanger public health or welfare. That is an endangerment finding. And their position is once the administrator decides that CO2 from cars may endanger public health or welfare, he no longer has discretion. And that lack of discretion comes from the word shall. So exercise your discretion to decide whether there is a risk of endangerment. And if there is, then you shall regulate. That's what petitioners say. I am anticipating the stronger respondent argument to come at this point and argue for greater room for agency discretion. Going back to the specific factors that the agency relied on to say in its alternative holding that even if it had authority, it would not regulate. As I said, they had 4 points. They said Clean Air Act regulation would result in an inefficient and piecemeal approach to climate change. They said climate change raises foreign policy considerations. The technologies might be available. And fourth, that the science of climate change is uncertain. The petitioner's position is, and I should say EPA didn't tease out how much it was relying on any of those 4 factors. It just said, even if we had authority, we wouldn't regulate, and here are 4 reasons why. The petitioner's position is, A, as I said, the administrator's judgment is limited to whether there would be endangerment here, and B, the only one of those 4 factors that even arguably is relevant to an endangerment finding is the scientific uncertainty one. So arguably, the administrator could go back and look at the science, decide there was too much uncertainty, decide that he could not conclude that air pollutants from cars might be anticipated to endanger public health or welfare, and that therefore he was not going to issue regulations. But petitioners say he can't do so relying also on things like foreign policy considerations and the need for a wholesale as opposed to piecemeal approach to climate change, et cetera. So all that the petitioners are asking for effectively is a remand on this question for the administrator squarely to address the question of whether air pollutants from new cars may reasonably be anticipated to endanger public health or welfare. As I said, I think this is a much trickier question for the court. I think the court probably will split on this issue. I can't really anticipate exactly who will fall where, in part for the reasons that that Richard discussed. We don't have enough data points. But I think this is, assuming that the court gets past the standing inquiry, I think this is where there will be a lot of wrangling. So going back to standing, I'm actually going to start by talking a little bit about what the implications of this case are for the states. As many of you know, the Clean Air Act expressly preempts states from adopting any standard relating to the control of emissions from new motor vehicles. That's Section 209A. But then there is an exception to that. The exception extends only to California. And only if California adopts standards that are subsequently approved by EPA, EPA can refuse to approve those standards if it finds that California doesn't need its standards to meet compelling and extraordinary conditions or that the standards are not consistent with Section 202A. Well, remember that 202A is the section that is principally at issue in this case. Then there's another provision of the Act, Section 177, that says other states may choose to adopt California's EPA-approved standards, and numerous states, I think 10, have done so. So let me walk through the history of that a little bit. In 2002, California, relying on this authority, passed a law requiring the CARB, the California Air Resources Board, to regulate greenhouse gases from motor vehicles. In 2005, CARB approved those regulations and requested waiver from EPA. The agency still hasn't acted. 10 states have adopted California standards. Those are listed there on the slide. In the meantime, various car manufacturers sued California and subsequently also Rhode Island and Vermont, alleging that the state's greenhouse gas regulations are preempted by federal laws and regulations, including expressly EPA's determination here that 202A1 does not extend to greenhouse gases. So if you remember, I don't know how to go back on this, but if you remember that the provision that gives California authority to do this in the first place says that California's authority must be consistent with 202A1, and the argument of the car manufacturers here is EPA has decided it does not have authority to regulate greenhouse gases from new cars. That is the definitive federal interpretation of this provision, 202A1. California's authority is only as extensive as 202A1, therefore California also, say the car manufacturers, does not have authority to regulate greenhouse gas emissions from new cars. Those issues obviously aren't squarely presented in this case, but it seems to me that they're relevant to the standing question, at least for the first question presented, that question of EPA's authority to regulate greenhouse gases, because 10 states are petitioners here, or 12 states are petitioners here. They have a fairly clear argument that the ultimate determination of what whether EPA does or does not have authority is at least relevant to a determination of whether states do or do not have authority. And the Supreme Court hasn't directly spoken to this, but has suggested, and lower courts have squarely held that states always have standing to challenge rules that may implicate state legislative authority. So I think at least with, I think that's the clearest, if not the strongest, argument for standing, at least on the first question presented. The second question presented, standing with respect to the second question presented, I think is likely to split the court a little bit more because on that second question presented, which is EPA's discretion to choose not to regulate, there is not this clear link to state legislative authority. And so there the court is going to have to sort of deal with whether it thinks that, that climate change is such a sort of generalized grievance that neither states nor individual petitioning groups nor individual petitioners has a sufficient individualized injury to raise the question. So just in brief, as I said, I think the court clearly will find standing on QP1. I think there's more of a question as to whether they will find standing on the second question presented, the discretion question. Assuming they get to the merits, I think they will find, I don't want to say unanimous, but I think there will be a lot of agreement that there is statutory authority to regulate greenhouse gases. I'm not sure what they will say with respect to discretion. And there I'll leave you just with the sort of thought question, which is it's not clear to me, even with my environmentalist hat on, that a remand to EPA for an endangerment finding is such a win for environmentalists. It seems to me, arguably, leaving a hole there that Congress must step in and fill would be a better outcome for environmentalists. So,
let me make a few quick comments and start out with a disclosure, as Don did. I've been involved in both of these cases, both the Massachusetts EPA case for petitioners and the Environmental Defense Fund versus Duke Energy, also for the petitioners. And that's important to know. In either case, I don't want to overshadow my role. In either case, have I played a major role. Others have been playing a far more significant role than I have played. With the Duke Energy case, Sean Donahue is the principal attorney for Environmental Defense, and has done really just a quite spectacular job. A few quick comments on Duke Energy. I think the court's going to realize the more they get into this case, and Don was sort of alluding to it, this case is far beyond their pay scale. It's an unbelievably complicated statutory scheme, and I don't think you're going to see them running to take a lot of these cases in the future. I think the reason they took this case, though, to me is fairly clear, as much as this can be. They took it, as Don suggests, they took it for the jurisdictional issue. They took it for the question whether the Fourth Circuit was out of bounds in reaching the ruling that it reached in this case. For those of us up here, for many of you out there, you know, whether a new source versus existing source, what a modification is, what a major modification is, whether you measure emissions increases hourly or annually. This is the kind of thing which, you know, makes us passionate. It makes our hearts beat rapidly. We love this stuff. That's not any of the Supreme Court justices. They were very happy to get off the D.C. Circuit, so they wouldn't ever have to see one of these cases again. But the fact is there are four of those on the court who are on the D.C. Circuit. Roberts, Ginsburg, Scalia, and Thomas. They all came from the D.C. Circuit. And what does make their heart go pitter-patter are things like jurisdictional issues, federal courts issues. That's their currency. That's what they love. And four of them know about the D.C. Circuit's exclusive jurisdiction. And that would be something they would care about. Roberts recently wrote an article on the history of the D.C. Circuit and its jurisdiction in the Virginia Law Review just this past spring. And my guess is that's what got the court's attention here. The idea was the Fourth Circuit went out of bounds. The Fourth Circuit said that it was simply interpreting EPA's regulation, not invalidating it. But since the regulation on its face says we measure emissions annually, not hourly, it's pretty hard to call that an interpretation. Indeed, it's so hard to say that actually Duke Energy has abandoned that argument in the Supreme Court. Duke Energy isn't really even arguing that all the Fourth Circuit did was interpret the regulation. As Don suggested, what Duke Energy is saying is, well, no, the reason there's jurisdiction in the Fourth Circuit is because this was a claim we could not have brought in the first instance in 1980. Because EPA's interpretation is so different than it was in 1980, we had no notice. We had no idea they were going to do that. They were going to do it annually, not hourly. And so this was something which we are allowed to bring because we could not have brought it. That's an exception to exclusive jurisdiction back in 1980. I think the quick short answer to that is they did bring it in 1980. And they're hard-pressed to say that they couldn't have, even if there wasn't good notice, because I think, in fact, they did. I think that's probably going to be the end of this case for this court. The more they see the merits, the more they're going to run away. There's a landmine in the merits here, though. And that is, this is an interesting case. In the Court of Appeals, originally, Environmental Defense and Duke Energy, Environmental Defense and EPA were together. Then when the petition for cert happened, Environmental Defense was on one side and EPA and the United States was on the other side. And that's because the United States and EPA want to change the rule, as Don suggested. They want to change it prospectively to, in effect, acquiesce in the Fourth Circuit's interpretation. A complete loss. So they didn't want the court to take this case because they want to change the rule prospectively. They're not abandoning this enforcement action retroactively. They want to change it prospectively. And the reason why this is significant is now the United States is back on Environmental Defense's side because retrospectively they agree this is what the regulation meant before. While they're both arguing for a reversal of the judgment, Environmental Defense is doing it on the fact that the statutory language in the first instance is plain on its face. Their backup argument is we're entitled to win because it's ambiguous, you should defer to EPA. EPA's only argument, they reiterate the reply brief they filed on Friday, their only argument is the language is ambiguous, defer to us. And they dropped a footnote, number two, and they say, and that means we can change it in the future. So even if Environmental Defense and EPA come out arm in arm, victors in this case, they're very quickly going to part ways in the future. On the Massachusetts versus EPA case, I see the first issue, the air pollutant issue, as a complete cakewalk. I think it's sort of it's one of those cases which I think it's hard to pass the red face test in arguing it in front of the Supreme Court. And I think we'll see the government, when they file their brief tomorrow, they're going to spend very little time, I think, arguing that greenhouse gases aren't air pollutants. I think they're better off, and they usually are pretty good at this, at focusing their ammunition elsewhere, not losing too much credibility with the court. I think they're going to argue, first of all, discretion. QP2, the question presented to, the court is very deferential to the government on discretionary issues. The government has a problem, and that is the argument they made at the cert stage was very extreme, and that is the statutory language in his judgment means. This is a virtual quote from the government's brief in opposition. When a statute says in his judgment, deferring to an administrator's discretion or any secretary of a cabinet agency, that means there are, quote, no procedural or substantive limitations on the agency's exercise of discretion. None. That's an extreme argument, which I think is a loser in front of the court. They're going to abandon that argument. They're going to recharacterize what, in fact, was the agency decision in a much more traditional administrative law way. If they do that, they have a much better chance of winning than if they come up with something very sweeping. As Amanda suggested, the environmentalist response, which I think is the strategically the best response they have, the only way they can win the case, and that is to argue, well, we're not asking for very much. All we're saying is the lower courts got it wrong in interpreting the statutory language, the meaning of endangerment, and its judgment at the end of the case. Once you decide that, you just remand it back to the agency for a proper interpretation of the meaning of the word endangerment. By asking for very little, they're asking for very little, it's the one way they have of actually winning. But here again, there's a landmine in this case, and it's a big one, and that's the standing issue. And the government's filing its brief tomorrow. That's when you're going to see them bring standing. It's jurisdictional. They flagged the brief in opposition. That's what takes this case from one thing and makes it a huge case. Because if the Supreme Court says that global climate change causation, cause and effect in the global climate change context, is not susceptible to Article III case and controversy standing. If they say that, and that's basically the argument we made, that cause and effect is too attenuated, it's too uncertain for it to have immediate concrete injury, it's too uncertain to show a causal nexus, and it's too uncertain to show redressability under Article III, that any order you're going to get from a court is going to do anything about it because so much happens around the globe. That's Sentell's argument. If the Supreme Court says that, that doesn't just affect this case. That affects all the federal court litigation, about 14 cases right now involving global climate change in the federal courts. And you see standing being raised in all those cases. Sometimes they go off on political question, like the court did in New York, but it's all part of the sort of wrapped up into the same idea. If the court does that, that's a really big deal. And that was the danger in seeking cert in this case. Now, what the court will do, I don't know. But here's what I can say on that one. There are two justices who are looking to do something significant on standing, and that's Justice Scalia and Justice Thomas. Justice Scalia wrote a whole series of very important opinions in the early 1990s in this area, and he lost ground in the Friends of the Earth v. Lay Law Clean Water Act case a few years ago written by Justice Ginsburg. And he found himself in dissent. He lost a lot of ground there. This, if he can recapture that ground, this is good news for sort of his view of the proper role of the court. It's not anti-environmental for him. It's the proper role of the federal judiciary. There are four justices who I think will be very hostile to the standing argument, and that's Stevens, Souter, Ginsburg, and Breyer. So that's two versus four. The big question then is, the Chief Justice and Justice Alito? We don't know, but there's a few tea leaves here. Justice Alito joined a very aggressive opinion limiting citizen suit standing when he was on the Third Circuit, a case called Magnesium Electron of the New Jersey Public Interest Research Group, a case that was in effect overruled in a separate case, the Friends of the Earth v. Lay Law case. In that case, Alito joined an opinion which was very much like the dissent in Friends of the Earth v. Lay Law, which is a subsequent case. So Alito seems to be on that side. Roberts, there's reason to think that he might be fairly interested in a more aggressive limitations on citizen suit standing. It's too soon to tell, but that much more consistent with his notion of judicial minimalism. It's much more consistent with the notion of keeping courts out of things. And he argued, which means very little, but he argued Lujan v. National Wildlife Federation in the Supreme Court for the government. He wrote a law review article in the Duke Law Journal afterwards, very favorable to the Supreme Court's opinion. So there, again, there's reason to think that he might be sympathetic or at least quite interested in the issue. And he wrote an opinion for the court last term at 9-0 called Daimler-Chrysler, involving the negative implications of the Commerce Clause, where it has a lot of language which you could quite easily use from Daimler-Chrysler to turn around and say there's no standing in this case if someone wants to do that. The key then, I think, the most likely fifth vote, I don't know about Roberts and Leo, but the most likely fifth vote, and all you care about is the fifth vote. It's great to get the 6th, 7th, 8th, and 9th, but the fifth is the one you care about. That's Justice Kennedy. And Kennedy here is the key, I think, and Kennedy on the standing issue, he did not join all of Scalia's opinion in Lujan v. Defenders of Wildlife, an Endangered Species Act case decided in 1994. He and Souter wrote separately about how you had to go beyond sort of traditional common law causal chains with these kinds of new attenuated injuries that arose in the environmental context. He showed sensitivity to that issue back then. I think there's reason that they can hope to tap into him here. He was in the majority in Friends of the Earth v. Laidlaw, and he's very sympathetic to states. He's a big believer in states. If this was a case which was just, you know, environmental defense and a bunch of environmental groups against EPA, that would be a tougher case. But this is a case involving 12 sovereigns. And the reason he dissented in Alaska of EPA was belief in sovereignty and federalism. It means a lot to him. He takes it seriously. I think he'll be very, very hesitant before saying states don't have standing in this case. And in Article 3 land, all you need is one petitioner to have standing. You don't need them all to have standing.
Okay. Well, I would like to pick up also on the Massachusetts versus EPA case, which I actually think is much more interesting than the NSR case for lots of reasons. Richard and Amanda, I think, have done an excellent job of outlining the issues, and I agree with virtually everything they've said, so I hereby incorporate their statements by reference, and I will resist the temptation to repeat them. I think the standing issues are very interesting and important, but I do agree with Amanda's point that the fact that the states may be affected under the Clean Air Act gives a way to reach a rather narrow Kennedy-esque result. I think it'd be a very different case if the issue were, does every individual American citizen have a right to sue for damages, which is a harder case in terms of standing down the road. Let me just mention a couple of issues about the Massachusetts versus EPA case. My former colleague, Bob Fabricant, who is general counsel of EPA, and wrote the opinion, which is or the legal opinion, which is ultimately being reviewed. I think there was an additional flavor in that of the sort of Brown and Williamson case, or even Whitman versus American Tobacco, that Congress doesn't hide elephants in mouse holes. And the notion in Brown and Williamson, which was the tobacco case, was that even if tobacco is literally within the language of the FDA statute, it's the kind of issue that is so big and so fundamental that it should be addressed by congressional action rather than by an administrative agency. I actually don't agree with that. I think that's a very pernicious and bad notion. I think in an era in which we find it so difficult to legislate, one of the positive aspects of the Chevron doctrine is to give agencies the opportunity to adapt to new situations. But I just would identify that. And I think it would be a terrible thing if the court were to buy that argument and were to say that there was a certain category of cases that are just too big for agencies to address on their own as a matter of interpreting existing law. But I think that's another strand that's in there. The more interesting aspect, I think, is the question of what factors the agency may consider, which Amanda talked about. The May in Danger standard was the standard that was at issue in the en banc decision by the D.C. Circuit in the Ethyl case, which was the one that upheld EPA's decision to take lead out of gasoline, 5-4 decision. I was Judge Bazelon's law clerk at the time, and he cast the fifth vote, so it's always been one of my favorite cases. It was written by Skelly Wright, and he talked about the decision that the agency faced as being a delegated decision of legislative policy, not to be reviewed with the rigor that is common for issues of fact. So conceived of the issue that an agency faces in deciding whether or not to regulate a substance as essentially a policy issue, not a simple factual issue. I like that way of thinking about it. I've written a number of articles saying I think the court took a wrong turn in the benzene decision when they essentially assimilated the question of whether or not to regulate a pollutant to simple issues of fact. I don't think it should be a law fact dichotomy, but a law policy fact dichotomy. And I'm in favor of a broad discretion to agencies to consider the extent of scientific evidence and other policy considerations. However, the D.C. Circuit in citing the delegated legislative policy decision language from the Ethel case, I think in a sense cut it loose from its moorings and said if it was a delegated decision of legislative policy that you could consider anything. And I think the interesting issue in the Massachusetts versus EPA case from an administrative law perspective rather than in terms of just climate change is if agencies can consider policies policies, what are the sources of those policy considerations? And on that, the Supreme Court case law, I think, is in radical conflict between Heckler versus Cheney, which is the FDA death penalty case, which basically said, more or less, agencies are free to consider any kind of policy considerations in deciding where they put their resources. Or Dunlop versus Bukowski decided just a couple of years later, a labor board case in which the court suggested that the agency had to articulate and would be subject to judicial review for its exercise of discretion. I do think that'll be an important aspect of the case, whether or not the language of the statute limits EPA's consideration to the sort of scientific questions of does CO2 endanger a climate. But I think ultimately the court should hold and will hold that if Congress intends to limit the discretion of the agency or the executive branch to consider certain factors, it needs to do that more explicitly and not simply by silence. That is, I don't believe the court would say that simply the enumeration of one factor for the agency to consider would automatically exclude consideration of other factors, nor do I think it should say that. And I think that there may be some factors that constitutionally Congress may not preclude, even if it does that, if it does so specifically. There's that old CAB versus Waterman case from 1954, in which it was held by the Supreme Court that because foreign airline rights involve foreign policy considerations, it was a political question, not subject to resolution by courts. So I think it would be difficult for the agents for the Congress to restrict the executive branch from considering the foreign policy implications of a subject that it was currently involved in treaty negotiations about. But certainly, I don't think Congress did that here. I don't think the language of the Clean Air Act can legitimately be read as intending to exclude those types of considerations from being taken into account. And even if it did, I'm not sure it would be constitutional.
I'll add one thing on NSR, and that is that another thread that has been sort of going along through here is Don talked a lot about the difference between actual and annual emissions. Another thread that has been paralleling this is the difference between potential and actual emissions. And the D.C. Circuit has held that the modification definition is triggered by a change in actual emissions. And industry's position before the D.C. Circuit was that that this modifications provision would only be triggered by a change in potential emissions. So a plant that was designed in the 70s to have a certain potential rate of operation and annual period of operation, as it senesces, basically, as it gets older and pieces fall off, it can no longer operate up to that potential. And according to industry, you would not have to follow the new source review provisions until your improvement of the plant brought it up and past its design capacity, essentially. When they lost that issue, in my view, they moved over to the annual versus hourly test because it hadn't been as squarely decided against them. But I think they end up being essentially the same thing. The hourly test, what happens to a plant as it gets old is not as much that it can't emit as much per hour, but that it can't operate as many hours per year. So if you're talking about the test being triggered by a change in a plant's actual emissions, the only way to measure that realistically is to look at how much it emits per year.
Just to pick up on that, if I can, I think that's a very, very strong argument, and it was the argument that persuaded Judge Posner in the Seventh Circuit. And I think that was a big loss for industry because Judge Posner is very highly respected and very conservative, and I think he followed that. What Sidley and Austin and Hunt and Williams do in the Duke brief, and all kidding aside, I think it's an excellent, excellent brief. I think they attempt to defang that argument, that policy argument, to a certain extent by embedding the discussion of modification very clearly in the wording of construction. And they point out that the technical amendment in 1977 was a gloss on the word construction, and it said construction including modification. So their argument is that what Congress intended to do was to reach those physical changes in plants that were tantamount to the construction of a new plant, i.e. by building a plant that would have emissions larger than the original plant. So I agree with you. The hardest argument for industry is the policy argument that increasing emissions, you know, the environment doesn't care whether the emission rate is increased. It cares whether or not the actual emissions that it's feeling are going up. And I think the argument by industry to try to respond to that is Congress talked about constructing a new plant, including modification as defined. And as defined at the time was an increase in emissions. Was an increase in emission rate. So you can see how construction, including modification as currently defined, an increase in emission rate. So their argument is it's only those types of increases in pollution that are like constructing a new plant that are triggered. We'll see who's right, but I mean, I think there are two interesting arguments there.
And just echo one thing, then we'll take questions. The briefing in that case is really outstanding.
Yeah, it's excellent.
All three parties. It's really terrific, terrific briefing on very complicated issues.
Open it up to questions from the audience here in the room, and then people on the phone can hit 6 if they'd like to ask questions afterwards.
Greg Storm with Greenberg News. How much is for Don Elliott or anybody who wants to answer, how much practical significance does the suitcase have in light of the new Bush administration regulations, in light of the fact that some companies like the client have settled the enforcement case?
Well, I think it's huge as far as air pollution law goes, just in terms of its practical effects, because the price tag on the Ohio Edison settlement was $1.1 billion in air pollution controls over a period of years. Ohio Edison is a relatively small system by comparison to some of the cases that are out there in terms of AEP, American Electric Power, and Duke. The government stipulated that under the Fourth Circuit's interpretation of the law, that is what industry said had been the law all along until EPA started its enforcement initiative, that they would not be able to prove a case against Duke and probably not against the other utilities. So I would say that on the outcome of this case certainly hangs at least $5 billion in air pollution controls. Now, what makes it a little bit more complicated is that in the meantime, the Bush administration has promulgated a trading program called the CARE Rule, which gets essentially the same air pollution reduction benefits in a different and more efficient way, at least in the eastern two-thirds of the United States. And part of their argument for changing the rules in the most recent regulations is that the previous interpretation is no longer necessary on a going forward basis in light of obtaining these controls in a different way. It's important to realize that if you don't require a plant to control under PSD or new source review, that doesn't mean you don't require it to control, because there are a lot of redundant programs in the Clean Air Act, and a lot of these plants are controlled quite stringently under other sections of the Clean Air Act. But I don't think it's irrelevant just because the administration would be changing the law. I mean, the issues in those cases involve repairs that took place in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, and those will continue to be the subject of litigation, as well as the government seeking quite significant penalties, financial penalties. So I don't think the 2005 rule change, even if it's upheld, and as I think Richard and Amanda and I all alluded to, While it's not in front of the court, I mean, one of the big differences between the United States brief and the environmental defense brief is they're sort of jockeying for position to hoping that this case, there'll be some language in this case that'll give some leverage on whether or not the 2005 rules are legal or illegal, with the government saying we have discretion, i.e. we can do the 2005 rules, but as Richard pointed out, environmental defense making its primary argument, no, you don't have discretion. The wording of the statute itself determines this issue.
I just have one follow-up on that. You say they're controlled under all of these other provisions of the Act, but this is a provision that is triggered by an increase in actual emissions. So if you're controlled adequately under other provisions of the Act, your actual emissions won't increase. So I don't think that's entirely responsive.
Okay,
Gerald Donato. I want to speak to ask a question related to the second set of issues that Don raised at the beginning, which is who speaks for EPA. I always thought I'm curious about this and many of the more recent EPA initiatives. Isn't who speaks for EPA, but whether EPA has spoken. And the difficulty, and I think what you have in this case in particular, is the way EPA normally, or any agency speaks, is through the APA, the notice and comment rule. And so the question is, what happens if you don't do that? You've got statutory amendments, you don't go through the rulemaking, and you issue your policies through enforcement action and general justice and that type of thing. And the question in my mind is whether or not that really is a waiver of the agency waives Chevron or to discretion. Because they haven't stepped forward, they have the opportunity to speak, but they haven't done. So does that take you back to giving the courts either more discretion or saying that the agency hasn't spoken, these are complex issues, you remand it for a rulemaking mistake? Yep, or do you want that?
Yeah, I think that really goes to the heart of what might be at issue in the case from an administrative law perspective. I think the problem is that in Harris versus Christensen and United States versus Meade, the Supreme Court sort of changed the rules with regard to Chevron deference. And I think at the time that a lot of these activities took place, the agency thought that the people who were exercising applicability determinations or the so-called clay memorandum, which was under an explicit delegation from the agency, they thought they were exercising the full Chevron powers of the agency because they had a delegation and that they didn't need to go through notice and comment rulemaking. I think that is called into question by Harris versus Christensen and United States versus Meade, which are only decided a year apart. But even those two Supreme Court cases tend to go in somewhat different directions. But I think what you've added to it, and that is that there is some kind of waiver or lesser deference by an agency to address the issue if it doesn't address it through notice and comment rulemaking. I think that would be a very helpful a principle, and I think it's one that comes pretty clearly out of the Federal Register Act. The Federal Register Act, which preceded the Administrative Procedure Act, has language in it that no one will be adversely affected by something that hasn't been published in the Federal Register unless they have actual notice of it. And again, the environmental defense and the government take the position that that there is a very clear exercise of Chevron discretion in the language of the 1980 rules. I personally don't see them quoting that so clearly in their briefs, but certainly there is a scramble by various parties to grab the high ground of, oh yes, we did say that in the 1980 rules, and these contrary determinations, applicability determinations a year later, that really shouldn't be given much weight because we said completely the contrary. You can't read the 1980 rules in any other way. Well, it's a little embarrassing to say you can't read the 1980 rules the other way, and yet the agency did for almost a decade.
I mean, it happens not infrequently. I don't think I think there are a few isolated determinations. It's not unusual to have lower-level agency officials saying things. I think it doesn't tend to be preclusive of the question whether there's jurisdiction. I don't think it tends to be preclusive in terms of any kind of deference. I do think it's relevant on the merits when you get to a penalty phase. When you get to, I think there is a point when, in fact, that you've been misled one way or the other, or there's some kind of notion of equity, that there's a place where it actually makes it make a big difference at that level. I don't think it makes a difference on whether it's jurisdiction. I don't think it makes a difference in terms of what the meaning of the statute is. But I think it makes a difference in terms of the remedy.
Well, here I think it makes a big difference in terms of the definition of modification. Because if you want to change the definition that applies to PD, to a different section of the statute, you can do that through a rulemaking process. It's very difficult, I think, to make that case by administrative order.
Right. No, I agree. I agree.
Theories that are advanced for the first time in enforcement.
Right.
I mean, the industry claim is that EPA essentially told them there was one set of rules, and then they purported and have been successful in enforcement in enforcing a different set of rules, and then it led the industry to believe we're covered. Having said that, I think the government has done a good job of getting the right case to the Supreme Court. I think the facts are not as favorable to the industry in the Duke case, where, at least according to the briefs, one of the plants was essentially mothballed and essentially completely rebuilt. And there also is some discovery that suggests that some people in the industry at least anticipated that EPA might take this position. I think it's different to say that that is the correct position, but there was at least some anticipation that EPA could potentially take this position in the future. So it's been hard for the industry to argue, you know, lack of fair notice or surprise in light of some of the discovery that's come out, showing that the industry was anticipating that it's at least possible the agency would take that position. Now, I don't think anticipating that the government might take that position is the same thing as saying the government has taken that position in a rulemaking or otherwise.
But it does make it a hard case, and I think that's part of what the briefing by petitioners in this case, where they brought out all the different earlier challenges and a lot of quotes from the earlier briefs, made a good case for them.
Can this case make it impossible for a future president to bring enforcement cases under the Clinton interpretation of the NSR?
It could, in that if the Supreme Court were to interpret the statute as having on its face a meaning inconsistent with the Clinton administration meaning. But I think that's extremely unlikely given the posture of the case. So it's almost a purely theoretical issue. The issues and the realm of discourse is either to say that there is a statutory interpretation that favors the Clinton administration enforcement initiative, the so-called actual emissions approach, or it's a discretionary matter and could be changed. I don't think that really in play is an argument that the statute has a defined meaning that the court must respect. That is the argument basically that the Fourth Circuit had made, and I think one of the things that armchair quarterbacks will be talking about when the decision comes out is whether or not the industry made a mistake in walking away from the Fourth Circuit decision and not defending it more strenuously.
Right. Well, the one who did walk away, of course, was Judge Luttig, who soon afterwards resigned from the bench.
Caleb Jaffe.
Yeah.
Hi,
Caleb.
Ask a question, but I just wanted to
in a case in which you're counsel.
Any case in which I'm counsel. But you mentioned that Kennedy sort of fondness for federalism and the dissent in the ADEC opinion. Given that PSD regs are actually state SIFs and are not the EPA's own regs, technically speaking, how do you think that factor is going to come back?
Well, I think that's that all that kind of stuff. In terms of the fact that discretion to states and you're giving states authority is favorable. And the same thing was done in the S.D. Warren case last year. The same thing was attempted to do in the Rapatos and Carabel case. I think there's no question everyone knows that federalism theme is important to Kennedy. I thought that one of the more telling moments in this case, didn't get any much press, is that Carter Phillips had a bunch of states, about four southern states, I think Alabama was the lead, filed a motion for divided argument to argue in support of Duke Energy as amicus curiae. And they did that because of their role of states. And they said, you know, because this is really important to the states and the interests of the states. That was a very clever strategic move because they wanted to, they knew that the United States was going to be with environmental defense, so they wanted to have the states viewed as on their side. I think that was a clear push to sort of say federalism is on our side. Interestingly, the Solicitor General, no one opposed it. Environmental defense filed a very clever response, I thought. They didn't oppose the motion because it wasn't coming out of their time, coming out of Duke Energy's time. But they said, we just want to point out that Alabama and company, those are four states, and there are actually about 12 or 13 states who filed on our side as amicus. So you may want to or not give them their argument time. That's up to you. But don't do it because they're the states, and the states are all on one side. And the court did deny the divided argument motion in the case. So that's, you can't read too much into that because they tend to almost never give divided argument to amicus. But I think that Carter Phillips is a very, very, very good Supreme Court lawyer and did a terrific job, I think, in a difficult context in this case. That's what he was trying to do. He was trying to ring the federalism chord with that because he doesn't like to give up his argument time to anybody. But he will give it to some states to emphasize that theme. I think it was over here first. Then you.
Well, I'm wondering what status of issuance of a permit or a permit that's been issued under notice and so forth
should have in terms of
the rulemaking. And of course, in the Water Act, is both a federal, but
more
likely a state issue, a federal permit.
I'm not sure I know exactly what you're asking, but I do know that in some of the NSR cases, and I can't remember whether it's Duke or not, the utilities had actually gone to the state permitting authority, asked them if this required a permit, had been told that it did not require a permit, and nonetheless the EPA is bringing enforcement action against them, even though this is classically a delegated program which was administered by the states. And what at least some of the states are saying, and Richard's quite right, the states are divided on this, but some of the states are saying, look, we're supposed to administer this PSD program. You told us historically this is what it meant. And when we then administered it that way, you then turned around, you know, years later with 2020 hindsight, changed your interpretation and are bringing enforcement cases in the teeth of those state applicability determinations. Now, that's not true with all the cases. They're all over the lot, but there are at least some cases where the industry went to the state regulator, asked for an interpretation, got it, and EPA is saying that doesn't matter.
There's a wrinkle in the other direction, though, to the extent wrinkles have direction, which is that the state-approved SIP only has to be at least as stringent as the federal program, and there are some states that very, very clearly have taken an actual versus potential approach. So there was some discussion, actually, as to whether the Duke thing could have been pursued by the individual states, even after the Fourth Circuit ruled that the federal program could only extend it.
But that means states can be more stringent than is required by federal law. They can't be less stringent. So
right, but taking an actual, a clear actual trigger would be
a state
be
could do that
more stringent, and then some have.
Right.
Is the point.
Right, and then but he was asking about, I thought, what happened when somebody got a permit determination, and would there be deference
right.
to that?
That? Right, I was just adding in a layer of
yeah.
question.
Right. Why, and then we'll take the phone, yeah.
Yes, I was interested in finding out how you all think the court, the Duke case, may impact or step into a question of what is routine maintenance.
Yeah. Well, that's why I told Darren a couple of years ago I think would take three Supreme Court cases, because there is a regulatory exemption, which I didn't mention. I kept it as simple as I could for routine repair, replacement, and maintenance. And that's not an issue that's before the court in the Duke case. So I don't see any way that we get any clarification of that. In fact, I think, I can't remember whether it's environmental defense or the United States, it may be both, But when Duke is raising the horribles that will come about as a result of adopting the interpretation that the environmentalists will do you for, they say, they will respond and say, no, that's not the case, because they're still adopting the interpretation team repair, the environmentalists argue maintenance. So I don't think that's an issue that's here. Now, I my prediction it'll take party Supreme Court cases, I have to acknowledge, is not looking as good as it did, because all of the lower courts, soon it'll be coming to a pretty case, as I have to acknowledge, is not. Not look here, but as it did, because all of the maintenance, with the exception of Judge Sargas in my client's case, who's the only judge to say that something has to be routine at the plant in order to qualify for routine repair maintenance exception. Most of the other courts have said if you can show it's routine in the industry, that that's sufficient to create that that safe harbor. But again, I don't think that, I mean, it's very important to recognize that the Supreme Court grants certiorari as to questions, not to cases, okay? So there's certain questions that are presented. So we're not going to get the Supreme Court's view on every NSR issue that is important in this case. They've really granted a cert with regard to two questions and two questions only.
And then the government is still waiting. They asked for time recently, extension of time, which decide whether to seek cert from the adverse ruling of the D.C. Circuit. So we have to wait a few more weeks to see whether they decide to get it. I presume that they're under a lot of pressure from industry. Industry would like to petition, probably. They've got less to lose by petitioning. On the other hand, industry knows that if they petition, the United States doesn't, then that tends to undermine a great deal of the force. So I'm sure at this point they're debating that right now.
Although, based on the recent history of the Supreme Court not following the Solicitor General's recommendations in environmental cases, no, just kidding.
So if the Supreme Court decides on the jurisdiction question involving Fourth Circuit and says Fourth Circuit did overreach D.C. Circuit's purview, would that have any implications on routine maintenance?
Well, it depends on what you mean. Implications on routine maintenance. There was a rulemaking by the Bush administration to try to expand the concept of routine maintenance to include a capital cost test, how much money you put into it, which would be a clearer line of demarcation, and that was what the D.C. Circuit struck down. And so that would be potentially a different case to go to the Supreme Court. Or if it doesn't go to the Supreme Court, then the D.C. Circuit decision would remain in effect as the law. But it's not very likely to be affected one way or the other by the decision in the Duke case. They're just separate.
Right. We should move to the phone, see if there's anyone left there who wants to ask questions.
What do you do, star 6 if you want to?
Yeah, you hit 6 if you're muted, and you need to be able to sort of ask a question.
Yeah, I'll jump in if anybody has something yet. This is Bob Kinney. I live in Doylestown, Pennsylvania. Where I practice up here, I was, first briefly, formerly I was environmental counsel for the National Association of Attorney General until a couple of years ago. Mr. Elliott said something here, and I wanted to get a comment from him on it, and I wrote it down because it struck me. He said part of the question, one of the issues in the Duke question was does CO2 endanger climate? And I wanted you to kind of elaborate on that, because I thought the question was whether CO2 could be a regulated pollutant. It's not an issue of whether it endangers climate as much as it is an issue of whether the agency has the authority to regulate it as a pollutant.
Right. Well, but that's the standard in the statutory language for determining whether or not something is a pollutant. I mean, there are two separate arguments. One, that it's not an agent because it's a naturally occurring. But if you think that it is an agent, then the statute talks about endangering public health or welfare in Section 202A1. And then welfare is specifically in Section 302H defined to include climate. So I was putting them together. I was basically arguing that the agency should be able to consider broader policy implications, but certainly one policy implication that is something that has to be confronted under, I think, everybody's interpretation of the statute is, does CO2 endanger climate? And when Amanda and Richard were talking about remanding for an endangerment determination by the agency, that's what the issue in an endangerment determination would be. So clearly, if the agency, if the court were to say EPA had the authority to regulate, then they would send it back, and then the agency would have to have a proceeding in which they would decide whether or not CO2 endangers public health or welfare, interpreting welfare to include weather and climate.